Hey, Mike, a lot of people in our audience aren't familiar with Air America or you because they basically write off commercial media in general as pretty much owned by the right wing. And I was just wondering if you could explain a little bit about your background and how you and Air America are different from that. And you aren't just a mouthpiece for the Democratic Party.
Well, first of all, I think the perception that media in this country is right wing is pretty much true. In some instances, I think it's more insidious than that. I don't think in some instances there's a political bent, i.e. right wing, at all. I think it's a corporatist attitude. Corporate America owns media in this country, and corporate America will make sure that media serves the interests of corporate America. It's very similar to a slave-master relationship. That's absolutely the way it goes. As far as Air America is concerned, I do believe that they are the corporation itself, Air America, or Pequint LLC, that is the parent corporation. It's pretty righteous in what they're trying to do. But let's not kid ourselves. They work within the framework of corporate America, and the rules are established by corporate America, and Air America has to exist within those rules, or they're not going to exist. Which is not to say that Air America compromises what they do. It is to say, though, that Air America seeks the same advertising dollars that ABC Radio seeks. They seek the same listening audience that Rush Limbaugh seeks. So there is a reality that if you exist in the United States and you own a business, whether it's a steel business or a sewing shop, a gas station, or a radio network, you have got to exist within the framework that already is in place. Now, I think what Air America does, and I think most of us who work at Air America are committed to this idea, is that we will not allow the content of the programs to be influenced by an advertiser or a corporate manager or owner. One of our ranking corporate officers, Carl Ginsberg, for example, in the 70s, was part of the Venceremos brigades that used to go to Cuba to work in the Cuba field, in the cane fields, and to work specifically to assist the people who represented the Cuban Revolution, which was not necessarily a support of Castro, because while Castro is a revolutionary, he's also can be a real oppressive bastard in his own country, like so many so-called revolutionary heroes can be. But the Venceremos Brigade, for those members of your audience who are old enough to remember, it was designed to offset murderous sanctions applied to Cuba by the United States, basically the same sort of sanctions that we applied to Iraq for 12 years after Iraq War I that resulted in 2 or 3 million children dying. So we do have people on our corporate board who have demonstrated with their actions that they believe in liberal concepts. Now, do we have leftists on our board? No, I don't think we do. I don't think we have any true leftists. So probably, as far as on air, the closest person who would come to that would be me. And my politics are not all that necessarily left-wing. I grew up in Toledo, Ohio, in primarily in the late 40s and the 50s, and Toledo was, at the time, a very stratified city. You had the working class, and then you had the boss class, and I was part of the blue-collar working class. Toledo was a feeder city for Detroit, for the auto industry, and everybody was union. There was a lot of racial bigotry in Toledo in the 40s and 50s, and during the period when I grew up. But there was an attitude of not allowing the ruling class to separate us with stuff like racism or homophobia or sexism or what have you. Now, in the 50s, that was pretty much not noticed, but the effort was going on anyway to resist the attempt by the ruling class to separate us. So that's the kind of background, Bill, that I come out of. We were not, you know, I didn't attend any, I wasn't a red diaper baby. I didn't attend any communist cell meetings. But the attitude that I grew up with could only be defined as a liberal left, because it believed in the attitude that I was given, believed in justice and fair play and a chance for everybody to make it in this country. So my working at Air America Radio, as far as I'm concerned, is sort of the capstone to a 20-year-long career I've had at radio, which is not a lot of time. I mean, I got into radio late. I was in my early 40s when I got into radio.
Oh, I didn't realize that. I've been listening to you.
Yeah, no, I worked as a writer for CNN. I was a newspaper writer, columnist, editor of yada yada. And I got into talk radio just actually by accident. But in all the time I spent in talk radio, I was usually the token liberal at whatever radio station I worked for. And I worked for a couple of real powerhouse stations, WSB in Atlanta, WLS in Chicago. These are 50,000-watt stations that boom out across most of the country, east of the Mississippi. So, but I was always the token liberal. Most of the programming on those stations was either conservative or right-wing or neo-Nazi. As we got into the end of the 90s, so many of these radio stations became neo-Nazi, and they still are. WLS in Chicago, WABC in New York, KABC in L.A., WSB in Atlanta. As far as I'm concerned, the political talk programs that they have on those stations, my definition, are neo-Nazi or neo-fascist would probably be a better term, because the word Nazi evokes the death camps and the Holocaust and some horrible periods in human history. But fascism, or as Mussolini called it, corporatism, is what we're dealing with now, and I think most of these radio stations, probably 99% of the radio stations in America, adhere to that line. They are corporatist, and in my opinion, they're fascist.
Oh, yeah, that's that was pretty good framing it there as fascist rather than Nazis, because Mussolini, as you did say, defined it as corporatism. I was just wondering, I know that you cover the panoply of social and political issues and don't specialize in labor, but I was just wondering, from your perspective, how do you sort of view the state of America's working class and perhaps any strategies that unions or other, maybe even new types of worker organizations could employ that might serve us better?
Well, I think starting in the Reagan years, when the federal government declared open war on organized labor, it's been all downhill since Reagan fired the air traffic controllers. By the same token, the labor unions themselves, and I like to specifically refer to the United Auto Workers, the labor unions themselves became almost mocking models of the old Soviet Politburo. The labor unions forgot how to be creative. They forgot how to make demands. They forgot how to shut down industries if they didn't get what they wanted for the workers. Labor unions have never operated without understanding that the company has to be in business in order for the workers to have a job. By the same token, the companies have never operated with the idea that the workers were anything but dispensable. They come, they go, it doesn't make any difference. That is clearly obvious in the way corporations have moved out of the United States as they seek the cheapest labor they can find. So the tremendous responsibility for the lessening of labor union representation among the working class lies with corporate America, no question, but there's also a lot of responsibility that lies with the unions themselves. And I think that's one of the reasons you've seen recently a breaking away from the AFL-CIO, a breaking away of two or three, the service workers union, the Teamsters union, a couple of unions who've said they've had enough of the same old from the union bosses who have become an entrenched class all by themselves. I got to be on fairly, I don't want to say good terms, but understandable terms with the United Auto Workers, UAW leadership, and I can tell you they were not working in the best interests of auto workers. And I think we can see this clearly now with what happened with Delphi, which happened with General Motors, what's happening with Ford Motor Company. The auto workers' unions, in my opinion, used to define all that was good about the working class or the middle class in this country. Post-World War II, the unions, especially the auto workers' unions, the steel workers' unions, the textile workers' unions, they were the ones that led so many people out of borderline poverty and into the middle class. But the weakening of unions, part of it rests with the workers themselves. So many people were enamored by this half-witted actor, Ronald Reagan, when he came into power, that they became Reagan Democrats. And I think any Democrat who has ever voted, or any worker who has ever voted Republican, has signed or assisted in signing his or her own death warrant where it concerns a decent job in this country. Nothing disgusted me more in the 80s than so-called late 70s, early 80s, and so-called Reagan Democrats. It was horrifying to see workers in this country vote against their own best economic interests simply because they didn't like black folk, or simply because they didn't think homosexuals had the right to marry, or simply because they didn't think that a woman had a right to choose an abortion if she wanted to choose an abortion. So these wedge issues that the political issues started with Nixon, finding those issues that could divide Democrats from each other, evangelical Democrats, Catholic Democrats, white Democrats, black Democrats. Republicans did everything they could to find wedge issues that would divide us, divide Democrats, and they were successful. So while I blame the Republicans for having minds like demons and being very insidious, I also blame Democrats for being so easily manipulated. So as far as unions are concerned, either one of two things are going to happen as far as I can see. Either unions are going to have a rebirth, a resurrection, or they're going to disappear permanently. If they disappear permanently, this is what the business classes or the ruling classes or the bosses have been pushing for ever since the idea of unionization in this country became a reality, is to utterly destroy collective bargaining. When you have 1,000 workers say no, that will bring a company to a halt until an agreement is reached. When you have nobody saying no, then the company can do whatever it wants to do to the community, to the worker, to the health and safety of the neighborhood, the city, until the company wrings every last drop of blood out of that community it can wring, and then it moves to Mexico and does the same thing. And then it moves to the North Mariana Islands and does the same thing, and then ultimately it moves to China and does the same thing, and then it moves to Vietnam. You understand what I'm saying?
Oh, yes.
Unbridled, unrestrained, unrestricted capitalism is a death notice, not just for people who have to suffer under its system, but also for the entire planet. That's one of the reasons that we have, or it's the idea behind, government agencies like the FDA or the Environmental Protection Agency or whatever the regulatory agency is. It was designed to keep capitalism in check. Capitalism can, in the right conditions, as far as I'm concerned, it can work more or less successfully. When it is not restricted, it becomes a predatory monster that eats everything in its path. And I think that's what we have seen under Reagan, Bush 1, Clinton, and Bush 2, has been just an absolute rapacious, devouring monster of capitalism unleashed. Clinton's signing of NAFTA and the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs, the GATT Agreement, and now this North American free trade agreement, all of these so-called and misnamed trade agreements are nothing more than a way to further exploit the workers. So there's a lot of work to be done. I don't know if it's going to succeed, it being the reorganization or the first organization of workers, whether they're in the United States or Mexico or Ecuador or Canada, it doesn't make any difference where these workers are. If they're not organized, if they're not working in a collective bargaining framework, then capitalism wins. The bosses win, the ruling class wins, and the workers lose. I don't see any other scenario.
Well, I'm worried that we'll go back to the bad old days where the capitalists will again realize that capitalism works best when it is somewhat restrained. You know, the bad old days of the goons and gunfights and everything else.
Right.
And, well, we've kind of got two legs of a political economics stool here. Republicans and the unions now. How about the Democrats on these issues?
I don't have a lot of respect for or faith in the Democratic Party right now. Now, you notice I said Democratic Party. I was raised a Democrat, capital D. I will always be a Democrat until I suck in my last breath. But the Democratic Party of Joe Lieberman or Hillary Clinton or John Kerry, to me, is not the Democratic Party that... that I think I remember. I may be wrong. I was too young for FDR, but from what I've read, the New Deal, then Harry Truman's Fair Deal, even Lyndon Johnson's Great Society, so many good ideas were put out there by Democrats in their time. But I think the Democratic Party leadership has gone right down the toilet. I think one of the things that really destroyed it was a result of Nixon's policies in the South. Nixon's policies, he called it the Southern Strategy, and it was designed to separate and divide Democrats so that Republicans could win elections.
Yeah, it's basically a racist policy.
Right, it was racist, anti-woman, anti-union, pro-war, pro-expanding markets, yada, yada, yada. In response to that, Southern, white, male Democrats came up with something called the Democratic Leadership Conference. Now, among those who founded that, the DLC, was Sam Nunn, a senator from here in Georgia, Al Gore, a senator from Tennessee, Bill Clinton, a governor from Arkansas, and the list goes on and on. White, male, Southern Democrats who said, well, we've got to do something to negate or offset what Lyndon Johnson said when he signed the Civil Rights Act, I think of 1964. When Johnson signed that, he said, we have just lost the South, the white South, forever. Now, he was referring to Democrats in the South. And so the DLC was put together, and what the DLC is nothing more than Republican light. They're, I think the term now is DINO, D-I-N-O, a Democrat in name only. There was nothing I could find in the Kerry Lieberman platform that, to me, still represented the basic underlying principles of the Democratic Party from the 40s and 50s. There was nothing there. There was nothing in Bill Clinton's policies during his 8 years as president that I could see that truly represented the underlying principles of the Democratic Party from the 30s, 40s, and 50s. Now, I'm not saying that everything that Clinton did in the 8 years was in opposition to Democratic Party principles, not at all, but so much of it was. Clinton, I've said before, I guess in an attempt to be funny, I've said that Clinton was the best Republican president this country has ever had. And I still believe that. So as far as the Democratic Party as a force for social justice or workers' rights or racial harmony or whatever, all those old issues that most of us grew up with still being viable, the Democratic Party is not, as it currently operates, is not the party to turn to as far as I'm concerned. Now, I don't know who to turn to. I said I'll be a Democrat all of my life. What I have done is made a decision to back candidates rather than the party. When I get a solicitation now from the Democratic Party for funds, I'll send it back empty. 'Cause I'm pissed off. I'll send it back so they have to pay postage on it, but I don't put any check in it, and I don't put an explanation. By the same token, I'll send someone like Paul Hackett who ran for the House district in Ohio. I'll send him $25. I'll send a candidate money, but I will no longer support the Democratic Party simply as a knee-jerk way of saying I'm a Democrat, because I just don't believe in their principles. Now, what is hysterically funny to me is that a thug, an absolute thug like Zell Miller, who used to be my senator here in Georgia, will say I don't support the Democratic Party anymore because they have left me. And I think to myself, well, I'll be damned, that's the exact same thing I say. Mike Malloy, that's what I say. But, of course, Zell and I are coming up from, for example, from entirely different directions. Zell expects the Democratic Party to be the party of the neo-Nazis, just like Republicans. And I think to myself, well, you know, Zell should, you know, Zell wants to be a Republican. He doesn't want to be a Democrat. He wants to be a Republican, so go be a Republican. On the other hand, when I say that, what I mean is the Democratic Party's policies have become so negative where it concerns what the Democratic Party should stand for that I've just decided, like I said, to get out of it and support candidates rather than the party.
Another thing I've heard you talk about on your program lately is maybe things beyond electoral politics. You know, more like getting out in the streets. You think a lot more activity like that. I think that was something that really kind of helped push even Richard Nixon into becoming what some people call the last liberal president.
Yeah, well, there's some truth to that. As far as the people making their presence known, I think there's a horrible lack of that going on. The last big demonstrations that I participated in, and Kathy, the woman I'm married to, were the anti-war demonstrations prior to Bush's invasion of Iraq. It is almost impossible to organize people into the streets around issues these days, and I guess part of it is, first of all, a horrible attitude, a sheep-like attitude on the part of the American public. It's almost as though people don't care.
I'm sorry, Mike. I kind of find a lot of people almost like embarrassed about the idea of going out and.
Well, there's probably that too. There is a willful ignorance that exists in the body politic these days, where people just don't. They don't educate themselves on what's going on. We have the greatest media tool ever invented, and that's the Internet. We don't have to listen to ABC or CBS or CNN. We can get the information ourselves. We can share the information ourselves. We can organize. We can do something. I do believe in Jeffersonian concepts, some of them. You know, he was kind of a freak himself. But one of the things that he said was the Tree of Liberty, and I'm paraphrasing, has to be nurtured or tended to every now and again with the blood of tyrants and patriots. And I think what Jefferson was saying, he was alluding to the fact that you know, revolution is a constant state. It's not something, you don't have a revolution and then kick back and for the next 500 years everything's cool. That there has to be a constant dynamic, a constant tension that exists, so that people understand that they are operating within a system that has to be electrified constantly. Because if we don't, then the ruling classes, whoever they happen to be, whether we're in Germany in the 30s or America in the 80s or China in the 90s, the ruling classes absolutely gut and destroy any idea of justice or solidarity. So. I think it's, you know, one of the things that would stop the war in Iraq tomorrow would be 20 million Americans, which is about 7% of the population, taking to the streets and saying enough. One of the things that would force the Bush crime family to acknowledge global warming would be for 50 million Americans who don't want their children and grandchildren unable to breathe, for Christ's sake, to take to the streets and demand.
The people who will be clawing at the domes.
Well, that's the thing. You know. So the willful ignorance that exists in America today is really sad, and I don't know what to do about it. I hate to criticize my fellow citizen, but I'm not going to criticize the government or the establishment and leave my fellow citizen off the hook. It's up to us to do something. It's up to us to organize. It's up to us to say enough. It's up to us to say this is what I want and this is what I insist on. And if we don't do that, then we get the kind of government or the kind of attitude that results when the power understands that we are a bunch of sheep.
Well, Mike, that was really well said, and I might suggest that more people listen to you on Air America and other hosts that I particularly like, Laura Flanders.
Laura's got a great program. I love Laura. She's excellent at what she does.
And Sam and Janine are doing really well. I like sort of observing Jean's self-education in a lot of things she talks
about.
Yeah,
and Sam is, if I might say so, I mean, I'm not trying to be patronizing here, but Sam didn't start out as a talk show host, but in a very short period of time, he's damn sure become one. And yeah, I agree with you. I've got some really good coworkers at Air America, and there are a lot of people who are doing liberal talk who don't have anything to do with Air America, and let's not forget them. There are people out there struggling to get the message out, working in pretty much the same environment I worked in for a long time, where they might be the token liberal on a radio station, whether it's in on the West Coast or in Detroit or wherever. So Air America does not have an exclusive contract on every liberal talk show host by any means. There's a lot of them out there busting their hump to try to get the message out, and I think they should be supported too.
Yeah, well, like one example is, say, Tom Hartman, who I think still retains his other shows.
Right, Tom Hartman, Peter Werby in Detroit, who only does one night a week. He substitutes for me a lot when
I'm off.
Ray Taliaferro, who else? I'm leaving out all kinds of names, and I regret it because when this interview's over, your audience is going to say, well, he didn't mention blank. I'm thinking about blank. I just can't recall the name.
Well, they can probably find blank at a website such as radiopower.org, I believe.
Yeah, radiopower.org is run by a friend of mine, Shelby LePre, who always needs assistance to keep that site going. So if anybody checks out Radio Power, say, write her a check, damn it. You know? It doesn't have to be a lot, $20, you know.
Well, we have the same situation here at WEFT. We're a nonprofit.
Right.
And, well, anyway, Mike, we've run along quite well here, and I'd really appreciate you taking your time out to come on. I know you're
real busy.
Well,
my pleasure, Bill. Thanks for inviting me. I appreciate the fact that you called me up and asked me to be on. And to the people listening to your program, you know, I'd just say what we used to say to each other years and years ago, solidarity forever. That's what it takes.
Well, thanks a lot. Solidarity to you, Mike.
All right, sir.